As a Wonder Woman fan, I've always been very frustrated because given your history with strong female heroines, you always seem to sort of brush the character a little bit. You know, she's in Scary Monsters a little bit. She's in the Circle of Ten story arc you did with Byrne on JLA.
Yeah,
and then she's co-titular character on that miniseries, but it's really Lois Lane's story. Have you ever thought about working on Wonder Woman as long form? I know you're at Marvel or so, that would kind of probably get away with that. But at any point in your career, did you ever consider working on the character in greater depth?
Yeah. Bear in mind that as far as the John Byrne collaboration, all I did was script it. John plotted everything, so it's all his story. I'm just the guy who threw in the extraneous words. It would have been fun, but by the same token, I was having way more fun writing the X-Men characters, who didn't have 50 years of baggage. You know, Wonder Woman, again, would have been fun, but not. And really, the challenge, it seems, for writers of comics and of film is, it's not that she's a strong woman, it's just that Diana is a Greek demigoddess who isn't even a normal person. She's an animated chunk of dirt. Clay. Ha ha. We will weave clay and, you know. At what point in their existence are they in any way, shape, manner, or form relatable to the people around them?
For most of its history, DC Comics has had a very loose association with continuity. For their first quarter century, they were much more concerned with consistency than continuity. If they decided that a character had a certain alter ego, a certain costume type, a certain set of powers, they would generally stick to that. They would tend to maintain the core elements of the supporting cast. There would typically be tonal consistency, but beyond that, very little was immutable. If space aliens were popular, there's no reason why Batman and Robin couldn't fight them. If they decided that Superman needed to have an adventure in medieval England, he could fly through the time barrier and make that happen. However, DC Comics tended to have a formula, and with repetition, that could become very rote. So in order to break loose of that cycle, they would have what they called imaginary stories, which were more flagrantly inconsistent than DC Comics normally would be. And most especially, those were the stories where characters could die or be changed in substantial ways, knowing full well that everything would be put back in place by the end of the story because they were just imaginary. Trouble being, oftentimes, those stories were much more entertaining than the regular ones. And as fans became more fixated on mythology and building up from continuity, things that they could rely upon structurally to take place in each story, DC's disregard for continuity tended to make them feel irrelevant to modern-day comic fans. Ill-fitting though it might have been, DC editors became more and more concerned with maintaining continuity of their characters. And the less fantastic characters, like Batman, tended to benefit the most from that, whereas more fantastical characters, like Superman, were increasingly hamstrung by that. In 1986, DC Comics made their firmest commitment to continuity in the form of Crisis on Infinite Earths, where they did away with the vast majority of their most outlandish elements in favor of a singular, streamlined reality where as many things connected to that core as possible. Conversely, one of their most highly regarded books from that year, a book that broke through to mainstream audiences in a way that no comic had in decades, was completely divorced from any modern continuity of that time. The Dark Knight Returns arrived, still one of the most important works produced by the medium. Prior to The Dark Knight Returns, the Batman comics were in such a rut, virtually nothing being sold by Marvel was doing more poorly than the Batman titles, and essentially the only thing saving them from cancellation was the fact that virtually everything that DC was putting out was doing those kind of miserable numbers. The impact of Dark Knight and its sister or grandmother production, Year One, had on the Batman titles lifted them up to an incredible degree and paved the way for the Batmania of the 1989 Tim Burton movie. While the monthly in-continuity Batman titles increasingly follow the template laid out by Frank Miller, there is still clearly a hunger for those out-of-continuity, more daring works to be told with Batman, because those imaginary stories tended to sell much better than the monthly books, or at the very least, they had a much greater shelf life than the monthly cycle. One such example being Gotham by Gaslight, which featured a Dark Knight in Victorian times. It increasingly became clear to DC that these imaginary stories could be a marketing tool. they could brand them and attract people to reading these out-of-continuity tales that could be enjoyed on their own in isolation as finite works. And so in 1991, they began using the Elseworlds imprint with the book Batman Holy Terror, about a dark knight that acts as the greatest agent of a fascistic theocracy. That branding was very successful. It was applied retroactively to books like Other by Gaslight. I think they may have even put out some editions of The Dark Knight Returns with that branding. The entirety of the 1994 DC Comics annuals were Elseworlds stories, but eventually there were so many titles with the Elseworlds brand of such varying quality that the label was devalued and its usage was scaled back considerably in the year 2003. It's been sporadically revived, but it's never had the luster it once had. There were somewhere in the realm of 200 individual titles referred to as Elseworlds. Unsurprisingly, Batman was the king of the Elseworld. At least a quarter of all the Elseworlds produced featured Batman or his family as the titular stars. About half that many were devoted to Superman and his family, and about half that many were devoted to the team, the JLA, Justice League of America. Out of those hundreds of comics, only three featured Wonder Woman as a titular star: Amazonia, The Blue Amazon, and Whom Gods Destroy, the latter of which she was actually second billed co-star with Superman. As it happens, Wonder Woman didn't even have an annual in 1994, so she didn't even get that token inclusion that such luminaries as Deathstroke, Legion, and the Team Titans enjoyed. Today, we'll look at two of those projects, and we'll discuss one of them with its writer, Chris Claremont. But first, 2003's Wonder Woman, The Blue Amazon. Seven years earlier, writers Randy and Jean-Marc Lefebvre, with artist Ted McKeever, had begun a series of Elseworlds prestige one-shots, imagining the DC Trinity through the lens of German expressionistic cinema from the early 20th century. The first was pretty obvious, setting Superman in Metropolis, one of the earliest and most revered science fiction movies. No one knew if a book with such idiosyncratic talent would take off, so it was fairly self-contained. Batman was tied to Nosferatu, one of the earliest and most feared horror movies, as well as the classic The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. Superman's lore intruded heavily on Batman's, but it was still the Dark Knight's book. Finally, there's Wonder Woman merged with the Blue Angel, a non-expressionistic talkie that introduced the world to Marlena Dietrich as a canteen singer slash prostitute who lures a schoolteacher to ruin. What in the high holy F-U-C-K were these douchebags thinking? To further drench this project in excrement, the narrative is entirely dependent on Superman and Batman, while Wonder Woman is actually far more passive and certainly more victimized than the opportunist for whom this project was named. The creators might as well have gotten together to gangbang an actual Wonder Woman comic book and suffer through their well-deserved paper-slash-staple cuts. Rather than a pilot, Trevor's son was an architect who worked to preserve the legacy of Metropolis's grand designer, John Kent. The significant other of John's son, Lois Lane, helped the architect search for texts from before the time of smoke and soot. Lois discovered evidence that beyond Kent and his partner, Luthor, there was a third designer, a beautiful woman with eyes of ice. But the text has faded. Rather than continue searching out this mystery, Trevor's son had to excuse himself for his twice-weekly trip to Dr. Psycho's Palace of Sin for the burlesque performance of his beloved Blue Amazon. After her performance, literal clowns, the evil, creepy kind, kept patrons at bay. Roses were hurled to Diana as she made her way backstage. Trevor's son managed to talk his way through the clowns, as Diana liked him.
I have seen you. Every night you have come to watch me sing, yet you are not like the others. You listened with your soul, with your eyes closed. Thank you.
Diana gave him a hug. Out on the city rooftops, an animal stalked. As the cheetah prepared to move, she smelled the men. The cheetah had never known fear. In fact, she had never known men. She knew only immediate wrath and fury in the face of aggression. She struck, smiling, almost not knowing she did it. She felt like singing. With a swipe, a man was beheaded, blood shooting from the stump of his neck. More deaths, male and female, followed. Dr. Mabusa, the gambler, was another stated influence on this project, most embodied by Dr. Psycho, spelled with a K, who might as well have been channeling the creators as well. Trevor's son followed Diana and Dr. Psycho down a spiral staircase through infernal dens of opium and lust for sale. Reaching its bowels, grinning spectators watched as Diana was whipped on stage. Diana did not moan or whimper at this assault, while she shed her clothes for the amusement of sadists. Afterward, Trevor's son tried to help Diana escape, but they were captured by Dr. Psycho and his clowns. Dr. Psycho revealed that he had been given Diana by the late Luthor for safekeeping. Despite his hypnotic powers, he had not been able to break Diana's will to learn why she was so precious. The Nosferatu, Batman, caught up with the cheetah during her massacre and didn't last long himself against her claws. Slinking off in the dark, the distraction made way for Cheetah to burst in on Dr. Psycho and company through a window. However swiftly she dispatched the clowns, Cheetah fell under the spell of Dr. Psycho's gaze, and old secrets were finally revealed. Being a good and proper supervillain, Dr. Psycho proceeded to explain the whole convoluted story in his moment of triumph. The third Savanti was Paula von Gunther, the Life Giver. Paula and Luthor quarreled during the construction of Metropolis, so von Gunther struck out on her own to create Heaven, a floating island. The scientist created new, weird-form angels for her heaven, even though the authors offer no attribution to the island of Dr. Moreau. Cheetah was first among equals in Heaven, but not a true daughter to Queen Paula, who created Diana to serve that role. Eventually, the Amazon suffered from genetic fragmentation, behaving erratically and engaging in mutual strife. Diana was sent to Luthor in search of male seed to replenish the gene pool, and was gullible enough to meet the blunt end of a rifle. Luthor reprogrammed Diana as he had John Kent, and sent her to Dr. Psycho for safekeeping. Meanwhile, bloody war raged in Heaven, with the Cheetah killing Paula von Gunther herself. The Cheetah needed Diana to activate the purple ray that created new Amazons, as only her genes would do. Dr. Psycho cut a deal with the Cheetah to hand Diana over if the Beast would be so good as to kill the Superman. Trevor's son was to be killed, now that he served no clear purpose, not that he ever did, while Dr. Psycho used his newfound information to psychically probe Diana. He should have waited 5 minutes, since Trevor's son managed a well-placed kick, which magically restored Diana's psyche. The Wonder Woman broke free of her bonds, and the rest of Dr. Psycho's story was relegated to a footnote 21 pages later. The Cheetah gave the Superman a good fight before the Amazons descended from Heaven on wings en masse to not manage to kill the Superman, even with that en masse part and the part where the Cheetah alone was dealing damage. Meanwhile, the Superman was not alone, as Nosferatu opened up his asylum to create an army of cybernetically enhanced inmates to do his bidding. That's right, the scrawny geeks Batman usually fights, without any serious period redesign, plus friggin' Bane and some nigh-imperceptible steampunk affectations, versus Amazons in a junkyard rumble. At least the Superman and Nosferatu double-teaming still wasn't enough to take the Cheetah down. By the way, can I please lay off the hyphens and the thes before every name? No, the Wonder Woman showed up on page 57 to battle the Cheetah to the death after she'd already been softened up. Super. For someone whose life had been saved by the Cheetah, the Wonder Woman engaging in mortal combat for the throne fairly reeked of ingratitude. You raped and killed our mother. You tore Heaven apart. What you could not rend with your claws, you poisoned with your lies. I don't remember that stuff. I just remember Luthor and Dr. Psycho owning this book while Diana was a submissive plaything and the Cheetah was the only powerful female kicking any ass. So of course she's a wretched abomination who refuses surrender and dies by suicide, skewered on a bunch of phallic rods. In the end, Luthor's evil was once again acknowledged as being at the heart of this mess, because women can't have their own story or make their own troubles. Diana noted, "His lust for the woman that spurned him made us all his puppets." Then Diana carried Trevor's son off to Heaven so he could father a new race of angels, because narrow genealogy wasn't what caused a lot of this trouble, and one good man is the solution to all the woes of women. Dr. Psycho is placed in the cabinet of Dr. Wayne's son, with whatever other loony survived the Amazons, while the last page was devoted to the Superman and Lois Lane looking at a mural of Luthor, John Kent, and the woman identified as Paula von Gunther, even though she looks completely different from her depiction in flashbacks, so it's probably Marta, Superman's mom, instead. Yeah, let's ditch the titular star of this book 2 pages earlier, because it's not like she got in much heroism in this book. God, I want to punch this book in its stupid ugly face, if I didn't think it would shoot a load in his trousers like a dirty boy. Dirty, dirty boy.
Wonder Woman? Here now?
I have 2 different identities.
We all have our little secrets, don't we, Miss Wonder Woman?
Welcome, everybody, to Satin Tights, a Wonder Woman podcast. This show is about the Linda Carter television show that aired from 75 to 79. My name is Paul K. Bisson. My co-host in this wonderful endeavor is Ray Caspio, reviewing, I call it exploring, because...
I like that.
I want to go into every part of the show, every facet, every layer, its messages and meanings. We are not going to be dissecting the morals and messages and meanings of Wonder Woman, the TV show, because really, there aren't many, okay? It was not that kind of a show. Did it have some messages and morals? Absolutely. Here's my philosophy with podcasts. I want to be entertained, absolutely, but I also want to learn something a little bit, right? We love Wonder Woman.
Very much.
We love Linda Carter.
Immensely.
A true fan are the ones that can take a look at something that they love and go, oh, what a piece of crap that was. There are some stinkers in Wonder Woman that we're going to have fun talking about, because that's what we do. That's part of the joy of loving a show. First, before we get to the new original Wonder Woman, we're going to take a look at the 2 not original Wonder Womans.
Can't wait.
We're going to take a look at the pilot presentation that never made it to air, the Who's Afraid of Diana Prince, which was supposed to be a Batman-esque type Wonder Woman show from Dozier and Doug Kramer, and we're going to take a look at the often ridiculed Kathy Lee Crosby 1974 TV movie Wonder Woman. Spoilers, there's a lot to like in that movie.
Yeah, I like it for what it is.
If you accept it for what it is, you probably have a good time watching it. Until then, Ray.
Yes.
We're out of here.
Goodbye.
Superman Wonder Woman, Whom Gods Destroy, was a four-edition, prestige-format miniseries published in 1997, written by Chris Claremont, penciled by Dusty Abel, and inked by Drew Garassi. It begins in the then-present, but treats Superman and his supporting cast as though they actually did debut in 1938, and then, for the most part, age naturally. Superman appears to be a nigh-immortal in the 28-year-old range. Lois Lane is more than a bit older.
How did you arrive at writing the Elseworlds story, Superman, Wonder Woman, Whom Gods Destroy?
They asked. They said, do you want to write an Elseworlds? So I came up with the idea.
It was very unique. It reminded me a lot of the Man in the High Castle, where you've got the Nazi regime still in place and Superman combating that. It's basically Superman's the only hero in the world.
The reality was, if you're going to play with the past, it comes off fundamentally. The way the story's structured out is the Japanese bomb Pearl Harbor on December 7th. Superman sinks the Japanese Navy on December 8th. Japan surrenders on December 9th because, let's face it, the guy's going to melt your flipping island. And Germany never declares war on September 10th. And bear in mind that the anti-war movement in the United States, in terms of getting into the war in Europe, was quite pronounced. There were conflicts in the German-American population, the Italian-American population. So let's hypothesize that the U.S. did not enter the war in Europe. Because, let's face it, they had a hard enough time at that point dealing with the situation in Asia, because they had to deal with Japan, defeated, but you had to, you know, go in and occupy it. You had to deal with China, Southeast Asia. The fact that the war in Europe was affecting the struggle for Indian independence. So the U.S. was not looking eastward, but westward to the Pacific. And the point was, by the time Superman found out what was being done in Europe, it was done. The Holocaust had happened.
Without U.S. involvement in World War II, the Nazis ended up taking over most of Europe. And there's an uneasy peace between the U.S. and the Nazi states. That peace ended in 1963. Superman had finally gained definitive word on the Nazis' genocidal atrocities and traveled to the fatherland to uncover the remains of long-buried concentration camps to confirm for himself what had happened.
But the Germans, just to make sure that the United States understood what was going on, set off a nuke in Metropolis. Because at this point, Germany has developed jets, it has developed nuclear power, same as the United States. The Manhattan Project was not a fast action concern because there was no war with Japan at that point.
And we didn't benefit from Project Paperclip either.
Well, we had the benefit of the refugee geniuses, but again, the thrust was all into the Pacific. So their way of nuking Metropolis was saying, don't mess with us. You mess with us, we're going to blow the world. We're Nazis. We can do this. So Superman was told, probably by President Kennedy, just not John, it was Joe, Dad, who was his generation's Donald Trump, not to mess it up, don't get involved. His reaction was, F*** you all, I'm going to the moon.
President Bruce Wayne did not retaliate at Superman's request, as the Man of Steel was content to exile himself to the moon in order to avoid any more casualties. In this world, Wayne had been inspired by Superman's example, as depicted by Lois Lane in her writings, to forego vigilantism in favor of public service.
And he left, which is why we open with Lois Lane working out at 88 or 90 years old, wearing a Daily Planet t-shirt, but working out in a gym in New York because she wasn't in the city at the time, and she's now a reporter for the New York Times.
Lana Lang receives a mysterious package that unleashes a purple harpy from ancient Greek myth that wrecked city blocks. Superman came to the rescue, but was gravely wounded with injuries nothing in modern medicine could treat. Worse, FBI Inspector Henderson arrived at the hospital with word that the presumed missing Lang had turned up in Nazi Europe. Lois cajoled Superman into breaking the Geneva Protocols that prevented him from taking a hand in earthly affairs upon penalty of an international nuclear strike. The former lovers made their way incognito onto enemy ground in search of their best friend. Harpy attacks soon uncovered this attempt, and the Reich kept a close eye on their visitors. Lana had been drawn to Europe by Vanessa Capilidis, the Oracle of Delphi, who used Lang's poor hearing to shield her from the mesmerizing banality of Calliope, which had enslaved the Oracle. A reference was made to Morpheus of the Endless before Lana brained Calliope with a vase. The Oracle gave Lana a mysterious gift and then vanished, hoping to lead the supernatural forces that imperiled the planet away from Lang. Meanwhile, Lois became embroiled in a conflict between warring factions of Greek gods incarnate upon the Earth. Adonis and Atalanta were allied with the fascists, while Lois was recruited by resistors Artemis and Athena. Lois joined in a raid intended to free their ally Callisto, but instead sprung a trap. Athena was fatally wounded, and a swift escape was required. Ultimately, in a safe hideaway, the goddesses chose to sacrifice their lives to bestow upon Lois the gift of their power. Dressed as Wonder Woman, safe for being barefoot, Lois's youth was restored and her vitality enormously enhanced. More than an amazing Amazon, Lois was now an artillery-proof flying superwoman. Lana had previously found a statue of Diana, Princess of the Amazons, and was amazed at her resemblance to a young Lois. Further, Lana began to have visions of another Diana, the blood daughter of Athena, who had betrayed her mother to become the most dangerous Nazi in the Fatherland. In her new role as Oracle, Lana could foresee the inevitable clash of these twin titans with the same face. Much to her chagrin, Lana was also sensed by Diana. While all that was happening, Superman was defeated and imprisoned by the Aryan Pantheon. Before her passing, Athena had asserted that he was neither their only nor best hope. Wonder Woman was adapting to her new physique and raining holy hell on fascist scum. Superman was turned into a pillaging centaur who in turn captured and temporarily transformed Lana Lang as well. But Lana broke free from her spell, put a bit in Superman's mouth, and rode that bare-chested buck until she broke his spirit. President Hal Jordan and First Lady Carol Ferris were killed by harpies, while the Germans pushed the world ever closer to a nuclear annihilation as part of their reaction to Wonder Woman's campaign against them. Oddly progressive, especially for this world, that the FLOTUS kept her maiden name. And then, in 1997, mind, an African-American woman VP stepped up to replace Jordan. It's almost as if social conservatives were drawn away from the U.S. to Nazi Europe. And while we're on cameos, Maggie Sawyer, Renee Montoya, Harvey Bullock, Barbara Gordon, Selena Kyle, Oliver Queen, Dinah Lance, and Abin Sur all turn up or were mentioned at various points. Remember a minute or two ago when Vanessa Capitellis, whose last name was misspelled, peeked into the book? And Cersei gets name dropped once. I guess it's nice that 2/5 as many Batman-related characters were present to represent Wonder Woman's supporting cast in a book that she's the build co-star of. There are a bunch of reversals too complicated to get into here, involving Lois pretending to be Diana, and Clark becoming a teenage girl who is nearly seduced by Adonis before dying and becoming Superman again. Let's just nod him, okay? As part of Wonder Woman canon, Aphrodite and Ares are running the ground game for the good versus evil action, but in reality there's a greater game going on between Zeus and Hera where I think Zeus is on the good side? Plus, Ares is dispatched as an afterthought, so any semblance to fidelity to Wonder Woman's stories is an illusion cast by the use of the Greek gods, period. No sense getting bogged down in the details, but the main bad guys get punished and an armistice is brokered both internationally and betwixt gods and mortals. Curiously, the Nazis still keep Europe, and most of their Aryan super allies remain in place. The Lois, Wonder Woman, and Superman basically return to a familiar status quo as active superheroes with secret identities as reporters. Lana continues to act as their oracle, and the ladies are overjoyed to hear Clark finally recommence the novel he was stalled in writing since 1963. The heartbreaking work is published, including a German edition, and this tale ends with a Nazi crying on some steps after reading about the cover-up of the Holocaust.
Now, I'm sure part of this was motivated by Superman's absence, but it's really more of Lois Lane's and Lana Lang's story.
Yes, that's the whole point. Well, it's Lois and Lana within this network of a world where Greek gods are real. You know, Marvel has Asgardian gods, DC has the Greeks. And Superman is sort of like the catalyst, the MacGuffin, who keeps putting his foot wrong all through it. Again, the idea is to bring you to the conclusion where Lois ends up becoming the new Wonder Woman. And Lana becomes sort of like the sage. And the key thing is that Superman has been in a writer's block since 1963. He keeps trying to write a novel, and he can't, because the death of Metropolis is that story's equivalent of John Kennedy's assassination. And that's why the ending of the book is he's sitting down, and he starts typing, and we've already seen 3 panels, and he stops. And then he throws his typewriter a couple of miles in the moon. And this time he starts typing, and Lois and Lana are going, and they're listening really hard, And there's a pause, and they think, oh, God. And then suddenly you hear, tack a tack a tack a tack. And he starts typing again. And it's like, oh my God, the muse is back. And the last page is a member of the Nazi government reading the book and weeping. The implication, one hopes, is that not necessarily that time heals all wounds, but there is a capacity to grow and empathize and change. Because, again, this was the 90s, and we were looking around at Russia, Eastern Europe. This was pre-9/11. There was a sense that with Clinton's two terms that the world might be heading to a better place. Who knew? But there you go.
I'm afraid that's all the material I have with Chris Claremont, so we'll move on to the art front. I've always been a big fan of Dusty Abel's work. I saw it fairly often in the 90s, so I never realized how little he'd done comics until I checked for this podcast and realized I just happened to encounter nearly everything he ever did in my days running shops. Out of the few dozen comics he contributed to, the lion's share were mainstream DC fare from between 1993 and 1999, my most hardcore collecting years at the publisher I was most focused on buying. And on what did he work? Pinup Gallery and Anthology specials for their biggest characters, the Secret Files and Origins reference books I picked up on Reflex, and key fill-ins like the Great Justice League Europe Massacre and Starman number 38. Whom Gods Destroy marks Abel's grandest scale comics project at just 4 prestige format editions, a total page count equivalent to about 8 standard comics or 1 slightly extended trade paperback. Also, I'll admit that he's a stylist, and his work at this time wasn't for everyone. The man clearly loved heightened, muscular, posed anatomy. It's a tad distracting trying to follow a story revolving around the Holocaust when the characters are all, check my glutes, brah! So cut! Wicked sick rip, yo! Also, all those guys who were tripping over that one Alex Ross cover of Citizen Steel with the heightened crotchular region would lose their damn full minds over all the thinly veiled man genitals straining under spandex and leather in most of Abel's industry work, but most especially in Whom Gods Destroy. While most of the storytelling is clear, don't expect much in the way of backgrounds, and most of the individual panels look like solo fashion or muscle magazine shoots. Having acknowledged those potential stumbling blocks, though, my eyes lather in every single page. At its base is the stark, simple, sensual elegance of Patrick Nagel, jammed into the beefy, angular expressionism of Mike Mignola, with a dynamic take on Art Nouveau lighting that recalls P. Greg Russell. I see elements of so many of my favorite artists, from Brian Stelfreeze to Kevin Nolan to Steve Lytle in his work, and I find his work so gorgeous that it's criminal he isn't more highly regarded or heavily employed. But, you know, he wasn't exactly prolific, and it's not like his efforts went unnoticed, because he moved into the more lucrative field of animation. His IMDb credits include King of the Hill, G.I. Joe Renegades, and numerous DC-related film and TV projects, most notably Young Justice. Looking at his deceptively simple line makes me yearn to draw with the full knowledge my efforts would wind up yielding tears. As for the script, well, additional caveats. It's very Claremontian. Of course it's as good a day to die as any, and with the best of company. Of course there are lengthy tracts of expository soliloquies and liberal speechifying. Why, yes, nude women do find themselves repeatedly in symbol-laden dreamscapes with rapey implications. Lead characters are possessed by demoniac entities and turn on one another in emotionally brutal ways, involving bestiomorphic transformations. Instead of allegories for minorities being oppressed and exterminated by authoritarian regimes, we have actual full-stop Nazis. If, like me, you grew up on Claremont X-Men, you will probably embrace his familiar idiosyncrasies and may find this one of the high points of his wilderness years between Marvel stints. The distinctive Tom Orzechowski lettering only reinforces the nostalgia. As I swirl it all in my glass, the specific bouquet recalls late Silvestri, early Lee, Siege Perilous vintage flavor. All in all, I'm so glad Dusty Abel devoted the most substantial work of his comics career to something that resembles Wonder Woman's story. Claremont does him a solid by playing to his strengths with tarted up goose steppers that look like the alt-right self-image as the bad boys all the girls are supposed to drool over, instead of their Dockers and Tiki Torch reality as sculpted mashed potato people. I chose to cover this story this week because I've wasted 2 weeks not making much progress with another topic, and figured the lightly edited interview material I've sat on for over a year would give me a head start on a substitute. Serendipitously, a comic full of beautifully and mostly believably aged octogenarian women, driving swords into the swollen bloody meat of cartoonish, fetish LARPer racist Broheim, was exactly the sort of comic I needed in my life right freaking now. In DC's rush to push out trade paperbacks to quench the thirst for Wonder Woman product in the wake of the blockbuster movie, they might ought to consider collecting Whom Gods Destroy. Based on my talk with Mr. Claremont, his take on that character probably made my body temperature spike on account of the boiling. But that isn't especially relevant to a Lois Lane, Lana Lang buddy adventure guest starring Superman. I thoroughly enjoyed Claremont's handling of Lois Lane as sort of a Katharine Hepburn, Lauren Bacall mashup, and if I can accept the Wonder Woman bait and switch, I figure more casual fans may be even more receptive. Whom Gods Destroy was dedicated to Jerry and Joe, referring to the creators of Superman, and to Stan and Jack, creators of the Marvel Universe. There's also a dedication to a Michael, and I wish I'd thought to ask Claremont which Michael that was. Perhaps artist Mike Parabek, who surprised everyone with his premature passing in 1996. Obviously missing is a dedication to William Moulton Marston and Harry G. Peter, creators of Wonder Woman, whose usage in this book seemed more a practical commercial matter than one dear to the writer's heart. From my discussion with Mr. Claremont, I realize his views on the DC Universe are diametrically opposed to my own, and his referencing Marvel in the dedication demonstrates a strong bias in favor of their philosophies on storytelling. However, seemingly by happenstance, Claremont stumbles into a story that invokes the Charles Moulton comics more than virtually any other since those creators' passing. This yarn is insane, but informed by less-traveled tracks of recorded myth. It has very deep veins of humanism, moralism, feminism, and fetishism. The characters do not speak to one another so much as monologue at one another in highly affected, romanticized manner. Like Golden Age Wonder Woman stories, the tale functions best when accepted as functioning on dream logic, and as high fantasy that just happens to be incongruously grounded in a semblance of modern reality, with some recognizable political concerns. Despite its very overt opposition to fascism, it is blatantly sexualized and saturated in kinky BDSM imagery. This book is problematic in virtually the exact same ways as the seminal 1940s material, just updated for the 1990s, and by no small coincidence is more exciting and more exasperating than volumes of watered-down material in the decades between. There's even a happy ending involving the long-term, loving, supportive relationship between a male writer and the two women who define his life and work. Lois Lane certainly does not speak like Wonder Woman, and Diana's lore somehow isn't reflected in Claremont's take on Greek myth, but his own quirks and ideology seem attuned to the Marston frequency. Regardless of intent, Whom Gods Destroy is a fascinating Wonder Woman comic that barely involves an approximation of the Amazing Amazon. We received the Facebook attentions of Derek William Crabb, Ruth Sutherland, Grant Richter, Ryan Daly, DeBeche, Michael Wagner, and Keith G. Baker, as well as Twitter affection from the 108th Sage, Andy Pandini, Dr. Ange, Avatar of the Green, Between the Pages, Bill Bear, Blue Girl, Bob Currer, Brody's Kitchen, Buddy Woody, Chris Sheehan, Coffee and Comics Blog and Podcast, Columbus Comics Corner, Comic Book Vault, Comic Reflections, Dmitry Pimenov, Dr. G, the Man of Nerdology, Ed Moore at Indie Comics Fan, Marvel Bronze Age, Miskatonic, and Teal Productions, Inigo Montoya, Felipe Alves de O, GIF of A-Holes Podcast, Glenn Hinutu Hill, Gord Tolton, I'm the Gun, Interesting People Podcast, James Hudson, Jeffrey Brown, Joseph Crawford, Justice's First Dawn, Keith G. Baker, Kevin Brackett, Mark Danvers, Matches Baloney, Min, Paul Hicks, Bose, Professor Frenzy, Punch Like a Girl Podcast, R. Douglas, Rad Adventures Network, Randy Caldwell, The Relatively Geeky Podcast Network, Resurrections and Adam Warlock and Thanos Podcast, Rob at Speculum Fight, Ryan Daly, Sean Phillips, The Silver and Gold Podcast, Siskoid, Slangwood Resists, Son of Cthulhu, Terrence Castanguay, Trekker Talk, Vinicius Carrero, The Wonder Woman Warrior for Peace Podcast, and Xenozoic Xenophiles. Trekker Talk wrote of the Darkness Within Podcast. Best Event Ever continues with a new episode of the always wonderful Diana Prince Wonder Woman podcast with Frank of Rolled Spine Podcasts. Justice First Dawn wrote, Half and Half on Eclipso? Let Rolled Spine convince you otherwise. Jeffrey Brown wrote, I have been listening to all the Darkness Within episodes of this podcast crossover and it's been a blast, but what I remember most of these is the Joe Quesada cover art. I'm the Gun wrote, Woof! Thanks Diablo Frank for taking the bullet on those Deathstroke and Titans annuals. And finally, Darren Sutherland wrote, I don't have an associate's degree in DC continuity, but thankfully Diablo Frank does. Thanks for a great episode filled with lots of terrific information. Even a shout out to Hammer Horror Films, which are favorites. And by the way, if you haven't already had enough of me talking about Wonder Woman this month, I had a roundtable conversation with a bunch of Amazing Amazon podcasters centering on the movie, but we certainly veered off into some tangents. It's a cool discussion. The first part of it appears on episode 16 of the Wonder Woman Warrior for Peace podcast. It is available right now for downloading. Wonder Woman is the copyright of DC Comics Entertainment. This is a non-profit fan-produced podcast. No infringement of any copyrights are intended, and where copyrighted material appears, it is, believed, protected under fair use. If you enjoy the show, please feel free to leave a comment on the Diana Prince is the New Wonder Woman blog, the Rolled Spine podcast blog, write to me at emailofdiablu@yahoo.com, featuring two underscores, or just hit me up on Twitter at CommanderBlanks or at Rolled Spine. Thank you for listening, and have a wonderful week. Thank you.